And welcome yet again to another edition of the Fringe Average Podcast with Jason Parks. I'm Mike Farron. Our music this week on the Fringe Average Podcast, courtesy of listener Evan, who is a member of the Really Heavy from Providence, Rhode Island, a three-piece rock band. You can follow them on Facebook.com/TheReallyHeavy or check out their music at TheReallyHeavy.bandcamp.com. They have a new EP out called Chatterbox. You'll hear their first single at the end of the show. Hello, Jason. How are you today?
I am good, Mike. How are you?
I'm fine. Are you still recovered from what was just the most exciting trade deadline in the history of mankind?
I'm busy nonetheless. It doesn't matter if it was good or not. I still have to do the same amount of work, basically. But
I don't care about your work. I just wanted to know if you had recovered from how bad the trade deadline was.
Yes, I've recovered. It was a letdown. I'm soft.
I liked it. What was it that you tweeted? You tweeted about all the talk being foreplay and you wanted some penetration with the deals?
Yeah, it's like, let's go, man. Come on. Everybody's trying to get too cute. You know, nobody wants to give up the prospect. Nobody wants to give up the Wheeler, you know, for Beltran. Nobody wants to get to Sherrod again. And I understand that. I don't understand the value of prospects right now. I understand that, especially with the way things are in baseball. But you know, from what I do, I want to see a lot more prospect movement because then there's a lot more attention on the stuff that I write. I guess you're getting more media spots. But, you know, it was just kind of a letdown. But, you know, that's the nature of the beast.
So it is. So we'll get into that a lot. Just a lot of our emails have to do with that this week. But we'll get into it and Let's get going and talk a little bit. Some housekeeping first. You can always email us if you have questions. And by the way, I think we had like 30-some-odd emails this week. I mean, legitimately, 30 emails with questions. So please keep them coming. There were a lot of fantastic ones that weren't able to get to because we have time constraints because Jason's got to get on a plane in the morning. And so we just – please keep pounding away. Keep asking your questions. We love the podcast emails, and you can email us at fringeaverage@baseballprospectus.com. And if you're in a band or you have friends that want their music played on the show, we need their permission to do it, but just you can email us there too, fringeaverage@baseballprospectus.com. On Twitter, you can catch Jason at Professor Parks. I'm at Mike Farron, SXM. You can follow the podcast at Fringe Average and join our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/Fringe Average Podcast. And if you use iTunes to download the show, please feel free to rate and review us. You ready?
I am.
First comes from Nick in Cincinnati, who knows, you may be seeing this week at the Cincinnati BP event.
I might.
Dear Professor and Mark, invariably one of the hottest topics in baseball this time of year is the value of prospects and how much sense it makes to flip long-term cost-controlled assets for major league players under contract for less than a couple of seasons. On one side, you've got some writers and media types seemingly bemoaning any deal involving prospects and others complaining that prospects are almost universally overvalued. One thing that really bothers me is that neither of these narratives seem to acknowledge that there is great disparity in value between the really high-end guys, the Buxtons and Snows of the world, and the back-end top 100 type guys and beyond that organizational filler. I realize this is a little long-winded, but I'm just wondering how you guys would go about placing value on prospects if you were running a major league franchise. Does it ever make sense to deal high-end prospects? If not, where's that cutoff line between untouchable and tradable assets? Thanks for reading, Nick in Cincinnati.
That's a good question. I mean, I've been getting this a lot on the radio spots I've been doing, you know. I think, you know, we say this all the time, at least I do, you know, it's got to be player specific. It's got to be deal specific. I don't think that there's such a thing as an untouchable player. You know, just looking at like the Boston situation and how everybody was saying that they could, the Red Sox could get Cliff Lee if they wanted to put in Bogarts into the deal. Well, you know, it comes down to internal scouting. What do you think Bogarts is going to be? Do they think he's going to be a 300 guy? You can hit 30 bombs a year, which is a lot of people think, and, you know, play on the left side of the infield. Yeah, well, if they think that and they think that he can contribute soon, he's not going to be a player that they're going to put into the deal because they think that he can make the current team better, and I agree with that. You know, let's say that the scouting is a little bit different. Let's say that you have a top prospect in the game, but let's say internally you don't actually believe that he's going to live up to some of that, those lofty measures. You know, let's say that there's somebody who doesn't believe that Bogarts is going to be a 330 guy. They believe he's going to be a 270-20 guy, which is still an awesome player, but a player that has less impact. And I think it comes down to impact potential when you're talking about the Buxtons, the Sanos, the Bogarts of the world. These are impact players. You know, guys that you get on the fringe of the top 100, maybe they could become impact players, but inherently they're probably not impact players as it stands right now. And I think teams are hesitant to trade impact players because that's what makes impact teams. You know, impact players make impact teams. That said, you got to look at the specifics of any given deal. Like, obviously, the Cliff Lee deal did not go down, and I don't know if another package was offered of lesser prospects, but that impact for impact talent trades, you know, you don't see a ton of those. And just looking at the deadline right here, there wasn't an impact prospect really traded. I think Mike Old was the best prospect traded. Maybe he's an impact guy. Maybe he's just more of a role five guy. There's some people who think he has more impact potential than that, and that's entirely possible given his defensive profile and his raw power potential. But, I mean, I think that, you know, the White Sox getting Garcia, you know, he's got impact potential. Iglesias has got impact potential. But, you know, again, these aren't prospects. I mean, young major leaguers. But, I mean, not a lot of impact talent went back and forth this year. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, teams wanting to keep that in-house, but having fear of trading away a player that could help their own roster.
You and I are texting a little bit about that yesterday, and I really don't like the fear aspect of it. You're afraid that you're going to get burned by that player going away. You have to have confidence in your own evaluation skills as an organization. You know, I think you nailed it. You need to know internally. You need to scout your own org to know exactly what you believe a guy is going to be. But at the same time, you can't fall in love with your own guys. And I think the other part of it is, I mean, there's two other parts to it. One, you need to know when it's right to be able to push those chips to the center of the table. You know, I agree it doesn't make sense to go all in for the chance at a coin flip game if you're getting a, you know, a two-month rental for a player.
Yeah,
That's tough to do. That's difficult. You know, I know this was in the pre, you know, two wild card per league era, but, you know, Sabian really put his nuts on the table trading Wheeler for 2 months of Beltran. You know, I mean, that was a ballsy move, you know, and certainly there's a lot of risk in that, but there's also that old kind of cliche about, you know, if you have the chance between the bat and the arm, you always take the bat because there's so much more that can go wrong with the arm. So I understand from that standpoint where you do that, but and I never fault anybody if they feel like they need to go all in. Man, if you're trying to make your team more competitive, more power to you at the big league level. But you need to have a pretty good assessment of where you're at. And I think the other aspect of it is financial. You know, for a team that is, you know, in the bottom third in payroll or even bottom half in payroll, you know, money is – every dollar matters because what ends up happening – and I think that it's probably been covered plenty of times before, but the teams that have big payrolls, it's not so much that they can sign the big players. It's that they can afford to absorb the mistakes that they make in free agency. And that's what the mid and small market teams can't do, and so it becomes much more valuable. You know, and you see a team like Pittsburgh and what they've done over the last couple of years in acquiring minor league talent. I mean, it sounded like they were, from what I heard, they put a significant number of chips into the center of the table to try and get Giancarlo Stanton, who wasn't moved and wasn't going to move. And I know the Miami Herald had an article today, you know, kind of refuting that. But I've heard that they've been calling for weeks and they were going to make a deal that would have hurt their system, but they would have gotten, I mean, an impact talent, a guy who's a 7 or an 8, you know, or an 8 potential, I guess, as a player. And, you know, that's when you kind of try and make those moves. It really would have put the offense for Pittsburgh over the top. It would have made a big difference for them. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where you have to be really good at understanding exactly where your system stands and where your guys are and how good they really are.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and just going back to that trade that didn't happen, I mean, man, if the Pirates really pushed in, that would have been incredible. I mean, because you bring in a guy like Stanton who's, you know, he's not just an impact guy. I mean, as you said, he could be he's a role 7, role 8 guy. And those guys just aren't available. Mm-hmm. You know, you usually have to grow your own or you get them in free agency, and that, you know, teams like the Pirates aren't going to be able to do that. And so you build up your farm system, and so you can create a package where, you know, Jameson Taillon and Gregory Polanco and Alan Hansen and Tyler Glasnow all become chips that you can then flip for this. And I don't know if that's the package. I'm just saying that those are, you know, four high, you know, top 50 type prospects. That they could, you know, that it's such an attractive package. You know, they have attractive talent at the minor league level that they could then turn into major league talent. And at that point, and if they can judge where their organization is right now, that they feel that that one bat makes them, you know, so much better than the competition, then I think that that's when you can push in. I mean, a lot of people gave, you know, Dayton Moore a lot of shit, and they, you know, rightfully so, over the last 7 years, and definitely over the Will Myers Shields trade. But we talk about it all the time and how, you know, you have to know your player. Now, Will Myers is definitely having a good season. He's hitting 330. You know, he's showing some power. I don't think that he's a 330 hitter going forward. I think that he's had a very good run. I think he's a very good player. You know, I think that he could be a role six type of player. But a role six corner outfielder is easier to find than a really legitimate top of the rotation type of arm, like a James Shields type of arm. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you have the ability to make that sort of move, you have to know your talent. And I love that move then, and I still love it now.
I think that that's, you know, I would like to see more teams, you know, not, I mean, do you feel like they're overvaluing prospects to some degree? I feel like that there's, because of there's so much focus on the financial aspect of it that those guys that Nick is talking about in the email that might be a little further down the list that aren't necessarily impact guys are being a little bit overvalued when, you know, just a couple of wins via trade or a win can make a huge difference for you.
I think that when you're looking at guys in the lower minors who have moderate ceilings but are still somewhat attractive prospects, I think that teams can, you know, hold on to those guys too much at the expense of picking up a win or two at the major league level where mm-hmm. it actually matters,
right.
You know, where it could change the fortune of your team for that year. And hell, I mean, maybe even beyond that year if you're able to go deeper into October baseball. I mean, a couple of wins at the major league level is going to mean a lot more than this guy in low A who has a 50-50 chance of even reaching his ceiling at the major league level anyway, which is most likely the ceiling of the guy you just got.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think that, yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of teams do, you know, fall in love with their own prospects too much and they dream on that ceiling too much. But, I mean, some don't. I mean, some will part with those guys.
Our next email comes from Michael, and it's somewhat related. He says, "Hey there, Mark and Star. When the second wildcard slot was put into effect, did Bud Selig intend for it to be a way of promoting competitive balance as well as enhancing the playoff scenario? Let me explain what I mean with that question. With more teams in contention for a playoff appearance, there will be more buyers and less sellers at the trade deadlines than in the past. My assumption is there will be more competition between contending teams for rebuilding teams' key pieces. Bigger prospect packages may be thrown around. Teams may be willing to part with a minor league player they'd normally hold on to for a shot at the pennant. Does this rule essentially hasten the rebuilding process for a team trying to right the ship? Does the playoff spot bring more parity throughout the league? Does it lower the value of prospects? The podcast really helps him break the monotony of mowing lawns all summer, but damn if the slack isn't contagious after listening to an episode. I don't give a fuck about anything until I get home. Thanks, guys." Michael, thanks for the slack, Michael. I think this is the other aspect of it that, you know, is affecting the trade deadline, or at least that's the perception, is that the second wild card has helped to change at least some of the dynamics.
I agree that it's accelerated the process. I think that it alters the process. I think it's ultimately about money. You know, and that's just part of the game. But I do think that it's an accelerant. I do think that it changes long-term developmental plans for the appeal of winning now, or being able to win now without having to win your division, without having to be, you know, a top-tier team, being able to sneak into the playoffs. I mean, you still have to be a successful team, but I think it does up the ante to do that. I think it does accelerate that. Is that a bad thing? I don't know if it's a bad thing. Is it a bad thing?
I don't think so. I mean, I think from a standpoint of competitive balance and parity, I think it certainly does, you know, give teams more hope that they can get, you know, even if you get into that coin flip game, you know, everybody talks about, well, what happens if you lose it? Well, what happens if you win it? Then you basically have a fresh start, and what are you down? Well, maybe your ace starter is going to start in game three instead of game one, and who knows, you may have been fighting to the end of the season to get to that point anyway, and your ace starter isn't available for that first game, you end up winning it. I mean, there's a lot of different scenarios that you can play out beyond that, but I do think it makes it easier for teams to try and see the light at the end of the tunnel. But from a standpoint of you know, rebuilding, making it easier to acquire those big talents for a guy, you know, for a guy that's a veteran guy, I mean, I think it actually hinders that a little bit, because I think teams are more willing to hold on to those to try and be in a point where they can get to that second wildcard team, especially if they're a team that's in contention now, knowing that they're going to have to rebuild some. I mean, that the problem with this year's trade deadline, as I saw it, wasn't this idea that we've heard bandied about, that there were so many teams that were in contention because of the second wild card, they weren't sellers. There were a bunch of teams that were not sellers because they had shit to sell. I mean, there just wasn't a whole lot of good talent on the bad teams that were attractive. You know, let's use the White Sox as an example. I mean, they moved Peavy, they moved Thornton, they moved an injured reliever in Jesse Crane, but they couldn't move Rios or Ramirez or even Dunn, and I don't know how serious they were ever in any talks for Dunn, in part because they're signed for next year to eight-figure contracts. And in Ramirez's case, he signed for two more years beyond this year, and that's a level of financial commitment that somebody doesn't want to take on in addition to having to give up quality prospects. Now, that's the issue with Lee. If you were to put Cliff Lee on the free agent market right now, you think he'd get 3-70 based on the way he's pitched? Be pretty close.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think that there would be a lot of people, you know, interested in his services. So, yeah, I could see that. 3-70, yeah.
But to have to pay that and then give up prospects on top of it, it becomes very rich.
Well, and not just prospects. I mean, like impact talent.
Sure.
I mean, you give up Bogaerts type. I mean, that you're getting hit, you know, in both pockets.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the other part of this is that there were a couple of teams that weren't sellers that may be seen as being on the fringes of contention or not in contention that weren't selling because they felt like for different reasons they couldn't. You know, Kansas City's gotten a lot of flack, but they're three out in the loss column coming into today for a wild card spot. I understand standing pat if you're Kansas City. They added a fourth outfielder. You know, Seattle, you can make the argument that they should have moved Morse and Morales. You know, I mean, maybe they feel like whatever offer they were getting from Morales wasn't as much as they would get from the draft pick by giving him a qualifying offer. Maybe they want to re-sign the guy. You know, and the other part with that is, I mean, there are asses on the line in Seattle with the jobs there. And from a clubhouse standpoint, you know, we've touched on this before. Young teams, you know, if they've got veteran kind of presences in there, and I know this is one of those unquantifiables that we're getting into, they can be a little tough to talk about or to try and figure out. You know, they really feel like those veteran guys have taken some of the pressure off the young players. And does that make it easier for guys like Franklin and Miller to get their first taste at the big league level and have some success?
I think there's a lot of value in that. You know, I know that it's something that's debated a lot, how much value. But I think that somebody who's been there before, who can aid in the assimilation process, the ups and downs, the failures and the successes of a young player, I think there's a tremendous amount of value in that. I think there's also a tremendous amount of value in a player that's been there because it can keep the temperature of the locker room consistent, can keep, you know, in a short series when things are very tense and very – you know, dramatic. I think that those type of players are the ones that keep players on their approaches, keep them staying consistent, in a certain rhythm, which, you know, at the end, I think would, you know, helps the player. So, I mean, I'm all for having those type of players. Now, who are those type of players? I mean, that's something that I'm not sure that I'm the best to identify.
Right. Right. And I think it varies club to club. I mean, you may not know until you get a guy in and then go, well, he's an important glue piece. So and I think that there's some other stuff beyond that, too. And I think not the least of which, you know, I'll use the Phillies as an example. You know, there was the story John Heyman wrote about the Yankees asking about Carlos Ruiz and being told no. And the Phillies could be thinking about extending Ruiz. You know, Tommy Joseph, who was going to be their kind of catcher of the future they got in the Pence deal, has had both a concussion and a shin injury that's kept him out for all but I think he's got like 40 plate appearances this year.
Right, and not the greatest catcher anyway.
Right.
You know, not a true, like, I mean, a lot of people thought he was going to end up at first base, you know, down the line anyway.
You know, it's so funny because I've heard that a lot, but in talking to people around the Giants last year, even after he was gone, the pitchers raved about Joseph as a guy.
I think he's good with pitchers. He's good with that relationship.
So, there might be something there, and they've got another guy beyond. You know, Valle might end up being a backup. I mean, he's certainly played. I think he's been playing in, like, the Mexican Professional League since he was 12, right? He's the most veteran minor league catcher in the world. But,
and I think that's what he is, though. I think he's going to be one of those journeyman, like, second and third catchers for the next 15 years.
Yeah, maybe you pair those two together. It makes, you know, makes some sense down the road. Mm-hmm. But our next email comes from Greg in Hell's Kitchen, and it says, "Dear Brock Landers and Chest Rockwell, the Mets are in year three of a rebuild that began with the firing of Omar Minaya and the hiring of Sandy Alderson, who quickly assembled a team of well-known Sabres, namely Paul DePodesta and J.P. Ricciardi. It's hard to judge the results without considering the obvious financial constraints placed on the front office by ownership. They've handed out just one multi-year contract to a free agent, Frank Francisco, and both players they signed to major league deals this past offseason are no longer with the team, Sean Markham and Brandon Lyon. The draft results haven't been great to this point, with Brandon Nimmo struggling and Gavin Cecchini unable to make a full season team out of spring training. It's likely that the Mets won't have a top 100 prospect this offseason the front office has drafted, assuming Dominic Smith is not a top 100, and disregarding Rafael Montero because he was an international sign. There have certainly been highlights, specifically the Wheeler and Dickey trades, as well as the Bird and Hairston signings. I could go on, but I feel like I need to get to the point. My question is twofold. One, how would you evaluate the job this front office has done this far? Have they drafted poorly, or is it too soon to tell? Can they be competitive in the next year or two? How is the front office viewed within the industry? Two, how much time is reasonable to give a front office that is rebuilding? Obviously, 3 years is too few, but seven, for example, Dayton Moore, certainly is plenty, no? When is it okay to say that it's time for a change? Does it ever get to a point where results trump process? Really great. I really enjoy the podcast. Keep up the fucking good work. Greg and from Hell's Kitchen." Fuck yeah, Greg. Fuck yeah.
I think that sometimes we, you know, it's hard to analyze a front office, you know, in such a short window. I mean, when does it become okay to evaluate it, though? I mean, is it 3 years? Is it 5 years? Is it 7 years? I mean, I really don't know. Personally, like, I don't love the way that the Mets have drafted. You know, obviously they've had some, you know, opportunities to get some impact talent, and I don't see it in Nimmo. I definitely don't see it in Cecchini. I like Dominic Smith. I do think that he's a top 100 guy. It's a weird profile, but I do think that the bat is legit. But you know, they've left a lot of talent on the board. They've been able to. Everybody loves the Wheeler deal. That was fantastic. The way that they were able to work the Dickey trade by getting like Syndergaard put in the deal too. I mean, mm-hmm. That's fantastic. You know, I mean, that guy's a monster. Their rotation is going to be really good. The problem is they're going to have to fill the rest of the team with something. You know, I don't know. I get asked about this all the time because of where I am, and I don't see the Mets being like a true contending team for the next few years, unless they can show that they can bring in some major league quality pieces to help augment, you know, the pieces that are already there and the young kids that are on their way up to helping. Mm-hmm. You know, which I don't think they have a lot of positional talent. Obviously, you know, everybody wants to know about Flores and whether his bat's real. I don't see it. You know, I don't see him being that kind of an impact talent. I mean, Wheeler's an impact pitcher. Syndergaard could be an impact pitcher. Harvey's already an impact pitcher. You know, David Wright is David White. And he can play baseball. And there's a couple of other pieces there. But, I mean, for the most part, I think that this team needs to add a lot more talent.
Especially,
they're a competitor.
Yeah, especially on the offensive side. I mean, I think it's a great question. And I think that in it, Greg hit on the key in the first part of the email when he says it's hard to judge the results without considering the obvious financial constraints placed on the front office by ownership.
Exactly.
So specifically with the Mets, it's not just the Madoff situation, but that they have some really bad contracts that are still on the books for another year. They'll finally clear Santana and they'll clear Jason Bay after this year,
but not Bonilla. They're still paying Bonilla.
No,
right?
$1 million a year until like 2031. So, I mean, it's been $1 million when he signed that contract, and $1 million now. That's like chump change, right? So
I know, but isn't that a great deal?
It is.
Great.
I mean, it's a good deal for Bonilla. That's probably why he's working for the Players Association now. The thing is that the financial constraints, I think, in any front office help to dictate where you're going and where you're willing to spend that money. You know, we can use you used Kansas City as an example, and we have another email on that coming up too. But they obviously were not spending any money before this year on their major league payroll. They bumped it to $81 million, I think, and that was a significant bump. I think it was about $60 million last year. So there's no money that's going there. They had poured whatever financial resources they had in the draft. And what they had done, in addition to, you know, making some poor deals with guys that they had been trading away, they were in a situation where they were trying to sign guys to, you know, try and put the lure of competitiveness on the field while they were building from within. And they really took a long, slow, low approach to it. You know, the Pittsburgh poured a ton of money into the draft. They cut back everything on the major league level. I mean, just everything, but went down bare bones almost to what like Houston is doing. They had not had a plan for 15 years. Now, fortunately, they had an impact talent in the system already in McCutchen and a guy who turned into a pretty good player. I mean, I think Neil Walker's better than most people thought he was going to be at this point, right? I mean, that's
absolutely.
So you've got a couple of guys like that.
And Marte,
that
are and Marte's a hell of a talent.
Yeah, and Marte, you're right. Marte was from the previous group too. So they got some of those guys in there. They had some guys in the trades that they made that first year they were there that didn't really develop till this year. You know, Brian Morris hadn't been an impact guy. Jeff Locke, I mean, shit, Jeff Locke's a great story this year, and that was part of the Nate McClough deal. He and Charlie Morton were in the Nate McClough trade. So, you know, I think it just kind of depends on, you know, where the finances are and how you can augment, you know, that what you're doing through player development in the draft. And if you're not going to go out and sign impact free agents, you know, you're probably going to take a lot longer on the rebuild. So I think it's a great question to ask because I don't think that there's a really good answer for it. And at some point, you're absolutely right. Results trump the process. You have to win at some point. But I don't think it's necessarily the same in, you know, in the Mets situation is different than the Pittsburgh situation, different than the Kansas City situation, different than the Oakland situation, wherever it is. Everywhere is going to be a little bit different. And I think you just kind of have to pay attention and get a feel for what the organization looks like to really know when it's time to cut bait.
That's a good answer.
Our next question, I'm actually going to skip ahead on our list here because this is kind of ties into it. And it says, Mitch and Jason, back when Keith Law and Eric Carabel did a podcast, I attempted to get them to address Jack Cerencik's horrendous tenure in Seattle. While they love to ridicule Dusty Baker's management, they never abused the front office. I figured I'd get more honesty from you guys, but after your Seattle event, you both seem to be still bullish on Jack's five-year plan, which if you actually count months and days, is coming to an end this October. I shouldn't need to lay out the details of Sean Figgins, Justin Smoak, Dustin Ackley, among others. I guess what I really want to know is why folks like you and Law wear kid gloves when it comes to front office folks. Are you hoping to be the next Kevin and you don't want to piss off a potential employer? Do you need good relationships with those guys to get the info you need? Or do you simply like roly-poly bald guys who think one in the fur bush is better than getting fistered? Love the show, Charles in Portland.
Well, I mean, it's not about wearing kid gloves. I mean, there's a time and place to offer criticism. It's the way you go about doing it. I mean, yeah. You can be an asshole about it, like Keith Law and some of those people have been about Dusty Baker's management, and some of it's funny, you know, but some of it goes beyond criticism. Some of it's just, it's almost personal at times, or it becomes, you know, a soapbox for people. And that's, you know, I don't want to get on that. I can mm-hmm. offer criticism of a front office. And, you know, I don't think that I'm bullish on anything that Jack has done. I mean, I've been critical of the fact that he's able to acquire good talent that doesn't always become good quality major league talent. It's been, you know, had some trouble in trades. I think that a lot of the talent that they've been able to bring up to the major league level has been, you know, decent talent. I mean, you got to look at some of the guys that have been up this year. I think that they've been good. You know, I love Miller. Miller's a hell of a player. Franklin's a good player. You know, Seager's a player. They've got some players, man, and they got a good farm system. The problem is they haven't hit on the big ones. You know, you want to see them, you know, everybody wanted Montero to be a star. Mm-hmm. Smoak, Ackley, these kind of guys. And Smoak's actually been better, you know, but he's had 5 years. And, you know, the plans that, you know, the signings that you mentioned that didn't really work, the trades that I mentioned that didn't work, you know, some of the draft picks that were maybe less than stellar or maybe you had higher expectations, you know, guys like Holtzman that you take number two in the draft and, you know, in a very loaded draft. You know, they're not free from criticism. They should receive it. I think that, you know, of anybody in baseball, his job is probably on the line more than anybody. I mm-hmm. wouldn't be surprised if he gets fired. Now, I know people in that organization, and there are a lot of things that they do well. So I can offer criticism in a very large view, and we can break down some of the things that they've done well and some of the things that they haven't done well. But I don't want to attack people because I do maintain relationships with these people, not because I want to get a job with these people, but because what they're doing is not easy. you know, what they're doing is different than people who get to sit online and take shots at them, because it's way more complicated than you realize.
Right.
And it's way more complicated than I realize, but I realize enough to respect it. And that's why I don't attack it.
I mean, I can only speak from my standpoint on this. I don't know what motivates other people to make comments that they do, but I use the same kind of cachet code when it comes to general managers that I do with managers. And that's that exactly what you said. I don't know everything that's going on, but I also shouldn't need to tell you what your opinion is. I can tell you, I can lay out the facts. I can show you what the mistakes were. I mean, we can go through, you know, if you want to go through Seattle's tenure and what their big mistakes at the big league level were. The first thing that they did was they overvalued defense in the first couple of years there. They thought that was going to be the next kind of foray into how the game was going to change, and they completely neglected offense at the major league level. And while it may have made their pitching staff better, and certainly the results at home were really good, their offense was terrible. And that kind of belied one of the great strengths that Jack Cerencik had as a general manager, which is he's a really good evaluator of hitters. He always has been. That doesn't mean he's going to hit on everybody. That doesn't mean he's going to hit on high profile guys, but he just kind of knows hitters. And, you know, at some point it becomes part of the player to be able to, you know, have success too. I'm just not interested in, like you said, being an asshole about it. But I mean, I think, you know, over the years, I've been plenty critical of organizations when they've made moves that I didn't think were going to work out. And then tried to explain, but I've always tried to explain why I thought they were coming from where they were coming from, whether I had the information as to why they were doing it or not, because I think you have to take a much wider view on it. And I just don't need to rip guys for that reason. I feel the same way about managers. I don't know what's going on at dugouts. I have no idea what's going on. I have no idea what other things outside of the actual stuff between the white lines, what dynamic is happening that can cause to create things. Does it drive me nuts when, you know, a guy who looks like a number eight hitter should be hitting number two? Absolutely. But there's got to be a reason for that. There's maybe a reason why. Maybe somebody feels more comfortable hitting in that spot. As ridiculous as it sounds, there is that in building that comfort level for a player. And I think from organizations and from managerial standpoints, it's very difficult to slam guys without having walked a mile, so to speak, in their shoes. And I have no interest in working in a front office. I don't want to do that fucking job. Are you kidding me? Jesus, that job is thankless. I mean, that's a lot of work, and I, man, that's not what I want to do. I'm a fucking radio guy. Shit.
Well, like, let's get back to the question here and not dodge, you know, the main tenet of it. Do you think that Jack Z should be fired after the season?
Do I think he should be?
Yes.
I mean, I'm partial to Jack. I like Jack. It's tough for me to say that, but I think based on the results that they've had over the last five years, you know, I think it's a decision that you know, I mean, if ownership wanted to fire him, I could certainly understand why. Am I dodging it by saying that way?
I mean, no. That's, I mean, a dodge? It's kind of a dodge, but I mean, it's... Again, I guess it speaks to the complexity of the question. It's not really yes or no type of thing.
I don't like to say, I mean, maybe this is me. Maybe I'm a pussy for saying it, but I don't like saying this guy should be fired. I mean, that's, you know, I'm not a fan of publicly campaigning for somebody to lose their job.
I know.
That makes me feel like shit to have to say something like that, you know?
Yeah, it's tough. I know.
I mean, it's easy. I mean, do you feel like that, you know, you can go out on that limb and say that they need to be fired? I mean, you can call me a pussy if you want to for not saying it, but
I don't know. I kind of agree with you. I mean, it's not something that I want to wear.
Yeah.
Because, again, speaking to the complexity of the situation that I'm not 100% familiar with, having a relationship with some of these people, you know, valuing what they bring to the table, even if they haven't been able to find the results, you know, respecting some of their process. Based on what they've done in Seattle, though, yeah, I think that if he got fired, I would understand it.
Our next email is somewhat related. It comes from Patrick in Dallas. It says, Mazzy and Starr, when Jim Hendry was fired, there had been some negative press about his work as GM. However, he's had various forms of success, so it will not come as a surprise if both continue to work in a front office somewhere. Allard Baird and Ed Wade are a couple former GMs that have had a lot of bad things said about them. Perhaps this is just my recollection, but I don't recall either of them having the same amount of success as Jim Hendry did. Both Baird and Wade have moved on to other positions in baseball. My question is, what do GMs with a bad track record in the majors do well, such that they move on to another front office job. Perhaps there is too much sensationalism on blogs, Twitter, and the like, but if you're somebody like me, you might think that an Ed Wade has nothing to contribute to a major league team. What things can you do well but still fail as a GM? Thanks in advance, Patrick in Dallas.
That's a great question because, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there are some GMs who have failed because, you know, a GM's job is so multifaceted. You know, maybe you're a good talent evaluator, but maybe you're not good with people. You know, maybe you're not good with the staff. Maybe you're just good at evaluating talent and you're put into a position where you're an administrator, you're a manager, you're a mouthpiece, you're all of these things that a GM has to be at certain times, and it's not what you excel at. You know, and then let's say you just don't get the job done as a GM. Well, you can go back into the vocation that you're best at, which is maybe talent evaluation, or maybe it's administration. Maybe it's one of those. Very rarely does a candidate possess all of these characteristics. Those are the ones who usually remain successful for a very long time. But I think that a guy like Ed Wade, I think he's got a shit ton to contribute to a major league team.
Yeah, I mean, I think it
depends on the team.
Yeah. I mean, I think you nailed it. I mean, that's what it is that they're very different jobs. Being a GM is a lot different than being an advanced scout or being a special assignment guy. And I think that those guys that have had GM experience, I mean, there's only a few people that have walked in those shoes, you know, and having somebody with that experience. I mean, I think we touched on it last week when we were talking about building organizations. You know, like the first thing Alex Anthopoulos did was add a whole bunch of former GMs to his scouting staff. I mean, I think that's pretty significant because those are guys that you can lean on who've been there before, who can help you make decisions. I mean, in the end, it's going to be your call, but they can at least help you because they've seen it happen before.
Well, and most of them have failed before, so you can learn mm-hmm. You can learn from their failures. I think there's a lot of value tied to that. You know, it just depends on what they're really good at. You know, maybe you bring in a guy who wasn't a very good GM, but he was really good at arbitration.
Right.
You know, that's a guy that how much value does that guy have? You know, especially if you don't have any expertise with that. Especially
right.
if you don't have any interest in that. I don't have any interest in arbitration.
Right.
What the fuck?
Well, I mean,
but I want somebody who is. I want somebody who's a badass at it.
I think, too, I mean, it's even – I mean, listen, let's use the Mets example that came up earlier, right? J.P. Ricciardi is a really smart guy, and Paul De Podesta is one of the smartest guys in the game. They didn't have a ton of success as general managers, but Paul's the perfect guy to run a farm department because he communicates well with people, he understands them, and he can help to synthesize, you know, data and scouting reports and send them up the chain. You know, J.P. can do the same thing. I mean, J.P.'s getting a good mind for analytics, and he can see, you know, what's happening, and he's – you know, he can help to recognize talent in different ways. And I think that those are, you know, that's goes back to, you know, building diversity of staff and what everybody, you know, brings to the table. But I think just because you've been bad in the ultimate job doesn't mean you're a bad baseball person.
Right. And maybe a guy like Depot, for example, is not the type of guy that can go out and talk to the media all the time and like play the politician like the GM has to do sometimes. Maybe he's just a guy that, you know, likes to do what he likes to do. He likes to do the scouting. He likes to do the numbers. Likes to bring it all together. Maybe he's not the guy that needs to be the face of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to know your role. You have to know what you're really good at.
And you know, just going back to the question before, I mean, maybe that's one of the things that ends up happening. You know, if Jack Jurancic gets fired, I mean, it's not going to be long before he ends up back in a front office. I mean,
absolutely.
The respect that people have for him around the game. You know, I think it'll show up in the way that, you know, you see some of these guys get let go. I mean, Hendry is the same way. I mean, shit, Jim got fired and like 20 minutes later, he's working for the Yankees, right? I mean, it didn't take long because the guy's been a farm director. I mean, he's been a scouting director. I mean, he knows how to evaluate talent. It's just sometimes when you're making the decisions, you know, that there's the other thing is that you can have all the right information and make what you think is the right decision and have it go horribly wrong. And you know what? It's still your ass that's on the line.
Oh, I know. I mean, it's just look at Jack just as an example. You know, what if Montero is a monster and what, you know, and really blossoms into the hitter that they've always needed in that park? What if Smoke becomes the man? What if Ackley was a true, you know, top of the draft type of talent and became the guy he was supposed to become? And then that whole team looks different.
Yeah.
You know, that entire team is like, oh, wow, look, you built this winner. I mean, obviously that didn't happen, but I mean, it's not like they were on an island thinking that those guys had talent. I mean, they were not alone in that.
Yeah. Our next email comes from Paul, and it says, Battlestar and Mitchell have recently become endeared to your podcast. And I don't know. I've recently become endeared to your podcast, as it's become the best hour and a half-ish of my baseball week. Particularly, Mitchell's laughter never ceases to brighten my day, while Jason's Dirk Diggler-type baseball lingo has become a customary part of my nomenclature. As a Phillies fan, I'm terribly curious what Miguel Alfredo Gonzalez is to become. My initial reaction to the signing was a positive one, simply because they've been so inactive in international markets in recent years. Jason, have you seen Gonzalez pitch before? If so, what are some of the scouting bits? If not, what are you hearing around the industry? Can you offer a projection based on what you've seen and heard? Mitchell, I feel like the price was a fairly steep one. Do you agree? If he becomes what Jason expects, will he warrant that contract? Thanks, and may Goldstein rest in pieces. Jason, that's from Paul.
I haven't seen him personally. I mean, he's been pitching in Mexico. But, I mean, I have several reports on him, and they're not married together, you know.
It's all over the board, isn't it?
It's not a happy marriage. It's like my marriage. It's like what it was. You know, there's a lot of people who like the delivery. They think that he's going to be consistent as a starter. There's some people who have some concerns about the delivery and the effort in the delivery and how it might point to a reliever future. You know, some red flags about the injury, and how with that and the delivery, that maybe that is a precursor to a delivery or a reliever home. You know, fastball can work. You know, usually low 90s can spike into the mid 90s. Obviously, there's arm strength there, good movement on the fastball. I think he's got like a 5 or 6 pitch arsenal, you know, with a changeup and a breaking ball and a cutter. And I think he throws maybe a fork ball or like just a really heavy splitter or some, you know, a vertical or heavy vertical changeup, whatever label you want to put on it. It's a deep arsenal. It's a deep arsenal from a guy who's got, you know, an idea of what to do with it. Obviously, the money is pretty crazy, but it's free market.
I think even, you know, we were talking to Charlie Manuel about this week, kind of get his report, and he said, well, I think he basically said, well, we think he can either be a number two, number three type starter, or he could be a back end reliever. I mean, like the reports that they're getting internally were different. So whoever they think is going to be a starter is who they trusted in this, because they spent a shitload of money on him. And if they didn't feel he was going to be a starter, he wouldn't have gotten this number. Because that's, you know, and I know you can make, you know, we can talk about the Phillies, you know, signing Jonathan Papelbon to that kind of contract. That's a little different than what you're getting if you're going after this guy. Whoever's making the evaluation that Ruben Amaro trusts most, it believes that this guy is going to be a number two or number three starter. And in the end, if that's the case, you know, the money's not so bad. You know, I mean, that's reasonable. If he's a reliever, it's a lot of money for a reliever.
If it's a reliever, it's a bad play. Mm-hmm. Because there's always other elements here. We're thinking that you're just taking a 26-year-old pitcher and giving him $48 million and saying, okay, here, you do what you do. Well, the competition level's different. There's an assimilation to a different culture. There's a lot of things at play here that go beyond just what can he throw. Mm-hmm. And so I think those are all factored in. But, I mean, not very often do, you know, if you actually believe he's a number two or three starter, I mean, how often do those guys become available at 26, you know, on the open market? You know, not all that often. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you do believe he's a number two starter, which, I mean, given some reports thought that I received, they absolutely thought he was a number two, three starter.
Sure.
Well, then it's a good sign. You know, but this is not something we're going to know for a while.
I think what's fascinating about him is the disparity in what you hear. You know, like that it's so extreme. Like normally you would hear, yeah, well, you know, he's got a chance to be a, you know, three or four or an impact back of the bullpen arm. But this is, he's either, you know, I mean, if he's a number two starter, I mean, that's an all-star caliber starter versus, mm-hmm. you know, a guy who could pitch in the bullpen. And there's a huge, I mean, that's for somebody who's 26. I mean, you generally don't see that anyway, but I think it's like, I'm really interested to actually see him pitch because I want to know why there's this disparity. I mean, hell, even the reports on his fastball are like, oh, it's somewhere from 88 to 95. I mean, that's like two full grades, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's also, I mean, it's like livestock at this point, because once he's been out of the country, it's like everybody's watching him pitch in these showcases, mm-hmm. you know, and these aren't ideal conditions to evaluate a player.
Right.
You know, not all the time. And so when you're getting limited looks, you know, you don't know how much he's had to throw recently. You know that he's trying to throw his ass off because, you know, the harder he throws, the more money he can make. I think that it's a dangerous way to evaluate. Obviously, it's a necessity in this situation, but it's a dangerous way to evaluate. It's not ideal. And so you really have to take a risk. You know, I think that the Puig risk and reward has, you know, maybe opened some eyes of, you know, maybe we should be a little bit more open to this process. Maybe the risk will be worth it because look at how extreme his talent is. There were a lot of teams that said that he was total shit, which obviously has been proven wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, and the Dodgers took a lot of shit for that at the time, if you recall. I mean, they took a ton of shit. And then what Puig did is after he was able to assimilate and ever able to get his body back into pro shape, you know, things changed and he became more consistent. And I think that maybe that's going to be a key here, especially when you're looking at a guy whose velocity is fluctuating from 88 to 95. I mean, what you want to see is consistency in that. You want to see, you know, him the ability to take off and add too, but you want to be able to see a guy who can come out and pump fastballs in the low to mid 90s and not a guy who's going to sit in the upper 80s, because then he's going to have a lot more trouble at the highest level of pro ball, which apparently he's going to go to pretty quickly.
Right. Our next question is a fun one, and it has to do with Cuba. It says, "Dear Dr. Parks and Maverick, thank you for the show. I celebrate the entire catalog."
I want to be Iceman. You can be Maverick.
That's all right. "I celebrate the Iceman's entire catalog, and Mav provides excellent cursing relief. I'm a Dodgers fan living in the land of the Astros and have been afflicted with Puig mania. So my question, if the U.S. lifted the embargo on Cuba, what would the effect be on baseball from a talent scouting perspective? Alternatively, where would Cuba rank in the pantheon of international player development if players did not have to defect to come to MLB?" Then he's got some questions that I want to go over in a second, but let's start with that first part of it. Where would Cuba rank in terms of overseas talent procurement?
How do I know? We've never seen the talent.
We've seen it internationally. I mean, we've seen some players in international competition.
Some of it. Yeah, traveling all-star teams. That's not. It's hard to judge an entire country's developmental system based on just a roster full of traveling all-stars. I can't even begin to get into that. I have no fucking idea. It'd be pretty good. They have a lot of talent. You know, they have structured leagues. I think these guys have a lot of feel for baseball. It's not just all, you know, it's not a showcase mentality. These guys play baseball. There's baseball skills, mm-hmm. You know, and I'd be really, really interested in that. Any kind of, you know, when you look at like the socioeconomic climate of Cuba, when you look at the education system, it's very interesting because oftentimes there is an emphasis on education. There's a structure. There's a structure in baseball starting at a very young age. You get these kids in playing baseball. There's not a lot of other distractions too. You know, it's not a world where there's, you know, 12 other sports going on outside their door. And I'm really fascinated by that because I think, you know, from a neurological standpoint, you get these kids playing nothing but baseball at a very young age. You know, I would worry about the assimilation process. I think that it would be a lot more difficult because you'd be opening their eyes to things that they've never seen before, or maybe even read before. I mean, it'd be crazy, but I mean, there's a lot of talent there. Can I speak to the level of it? No, hell no, I can't. I've never seen it.
I think what would be an interesting exercise, though, was if they were to lift the embargo. And since Cuba, if you're, what, over the 23 years old or you've played in the professional ranks there, you're not subject to the same international rules. You're basically, you're like Miguel Alfredo Gonzalez. You're a free agent. What kind of a spending spree it would be even on the most marginal talent down there? Because I think you've seen already, you know, who was the kid the Cubs signed last summer? Concepcion?
Yeah,
for $5 million or whatever, who is not really a prospect. You know?
Not really, no. And everybody was like, "Well, maybe he's a number five starter." It's like, no.
And then compare it to, like, you know, the Orioles have Urrutia in the big leagues now. They signed him for what, $750,000? Mm-hmm. You know, I think finding those guys who are pros there, if you were to lift the embargo, I think what would be really interesting is watching what the spending spree would be like, because since everything else is so regulated. I think they would be like sailors on shore leave. They'd be out just looking for any player that they could get to try and pump up their system to see if they get hit on it, because yeah, it's the best way to just buy talent.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm really interested for this to happen. I want this to happen, but I just can't answer it.
All right. The second part of the email from Matthew is just he's offering a series of multiple choices open to interpretation. Are you ready? These are kind of fun. One, velocity or movement?
Movement.
Velocity.
You say velocity?
Yeah.
Okay. I say movement.
I think it's, I mean, if it's open to interpretation, I think it's velocity plus command. Because if you can locate a four-seamer, if you've got a harder velocity with it, I mean, like, I understand that the, most scouts would tell you movement, but I think if you can locate a four-seamer with you know, above-average command, I think that that's devastating.
Command wasn't an option, though.
No, he said it's open to interpretation, though.
Okay.
So, power or hit tool?
Hit.
Clayton Kershaw or God? Kershaw.
Kershaw's real.
Kershaw. Puig or Buxton?
Puig. Puig's real now. Mm-hmm. Buxton could be something in the future, but, I mean, look what Puig's doing at the major league level right now. Buxton's a hell of a prospect, best prospect in baseball.
Do you feel uncomfortable at all with Buxton being as hyped as he is because he hasn't faced high-level pitching yet because he's still in A-ball?
No. Because okay. I'm projecting him based on, like, you know, his what could be possible in the future, not necessarily sure. What's happening now. So I feel comfortable with that. I like the multiple choice stuff. I like that.
Yeah, that was cool. It'd be fun to get some more of those too. If anybody had any other ones that they wanted to add in, I think it'd be a lot of fun. Our next email comes from Andrew in California. It says, "Greeting Mark and Parks. My question for both of you is about how teams measure a scout's ability to do their job. If what I've gleaned from reports and podcasts is correct, it sounds like most scouting is done on a one-man job basis, and there's a lot of trust from the organization on the scout's ability to correctly evaluate a player. Be they an area scout, a pro scout, or whatever, they're sent out to write reports on players just from what they've seen and turn them in so the bigwigs upstairs can figure out what they think. How is a scout's player evaluating ability actually measured, though? This leads me to a few specific questions. Do teams evaluate scout's ability to do their job just like any other line of work? Yes. Are they given performance metrics? And if so, what might they be? Do scouts ever lose their ability to evaluate talent based on old age, slowing of the mind, changes in the game, or whatever? Are scouts just sort of accepted into the profession, and once they're there, they keep their job as long as they do their work on time? Two, how much of a player's success do you attribute to the scout who found them? Let's say you have a Mike Piazza-like story where a guy comes out of nowhere to become a legendary talent. Do you attribute that find to the scout who claims all along he saw something? From an outside perspective, it seems to me like the random success stories are just that, random. It feels to me like you couldn't attribute that to anyone other than the player, but maybe I'm wrong. It feels to me like the more we learn about baseball, the more we learn about how much luck is involved. Take BABIP, for example. So much of player development is still a mystery to me, so any light you could help to shed on this skill, how much is skill and how much is luck would be great. Thanks, Andrew from California." Give us a lot to chew on. Let's talk about evaluating scouts and mm-hmm. what happens to them as they go on first. There's a lot of ways the teams do this.
Yeah, and each team is probably going to do it in their own way. I mean, obviously there are going to be, like with any line of work, you're going to be evaluated for your quality of work. I don't think that once you just get in, you're just a scout, you're going to be a scout. I mean, I know scouts that are better than other scouts. But I also don't know any shitty scouts because I don't think that they stick around long because I think teams are, you know, they're so stacked with talent evaluators that in turn they're also good talent evaluators, you know, mm-hmm. when it comes to personnel. And I think that, you know, if you talk to a scout for a ball game, you get a good idea of whether he's, you know, a really good scout or just a guy who's going through the motions. Those guys mm-hmm. don't seem to stick around very long if they're just going through the motions. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they're just a former player. They went to scout school. They signed with the team. They're going to go do it. They realize it's a grind. They don't give a shit. They're not going to last. You know, it takes passion, you know, and it takes feel, and then it takes experience. And, you know, you can't teach passion, and you can't teach feel. You can teach somebody what to look for. You can give everybody the tools to be a good scout. But if you don't have those things inside, you're not going to be a good talent evaluator. And I think that when you're evaluating scouts and on that level, I think that those kind of things become clear. If you don't have the passion, you see a lot of scouts who burn out after a while. Maybe they've been on the AAA hump for too long, and it's like, man, mm-hmm. I'm just bitter and I'm an asshole. And they become negative scouts. They're no longer scouting like what a player can do. They're scouting what a player can't do. You know, and those kind of scouts are just impossible to deal with. And it's probably because I'm still hungry for it, and I'm still like, I still have the passion. But once that passion light burns out, I mean, yeah, you still have your feel, but you're just an asshole. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that those are the guys who end up getting out of the game. Those are the guys I think that aren't good scouts anymore. I think that you take a guy who has the feel, who has the hunger, and who has the tools to do the job, man, even if you're going to be wrong some of the time, which is it's not a right or wrong business, I mean, those are the guys that you keep around. You know, those are the guys that I would want in any organization, personally.
I think too that you know, just to what you were talking about with the burnout level, I think it's responsible for an organization, at least a good one, to recognize, you know, where a guy's potential is as a scout, just like you would in any other business, and continue to challenge them, have them do different things, move them along. You know, if you're on the AAA hump for 5 years, I could see how that would get frustrating. But at some point, somebody probably needed to move you to a special assignment role. You know, if they valued your opinion, they needed to break things up, you know, whether it be going back to check, you know, on amateur players at times, or just vary things, or have you in the office more to give your expertise there. You know, all of those things are ways that organizations can help scouts too. And I think just from a standpoint of, like, from the amateur, I mean, there's a real basic way too. I mean, like, if an amateur scout files a report and it's good, they're going to send an area cross checker. And if the area cross checker likes what they say, then the national cross checker will come. And then maybe you'll get a special assistant or specialist assignment guy. So there is some doubling up. And I think what's really interesting too is that you'll see, like, you know, special assignment guys show up with scouts. And I always wonder how much they're scouting players and how much they're scouting their scouts at those events.
Yeah.
In those instances.
I agree with that. I mean, if you're gonna return a report on a player and you're two or three grades off the consensus that's also come in to the organization, I mean, then we gotta go back to, maybe you don't have the necessary feel.
Right.
Maybe you don't know how to grade a player. Maybe you shouldn't be grading players, you know? Or if you're that guy who sticks his neck out on a player, is like, look, this guy is a role five guy, I promise, and he ends up being just an org player, just terrible. I mean, you start building a resume full of those guys, you're not going to advance.
Sure.
You know, but if you keep hitting on guys, which is we're gonna fold into the second question here, if you're one of those scouts that, you know, has a knack for, as at the amateur level, finding guys diamonds in the rough, so to speak. I mean, not the Piazza story, that's a bit extreme. But, you know, there is a talent there. You know, there is, you know, one example, and I've mentioned it before, but it's a true story here. You know, Chris Kemp of the Rangers found CJ Edwards in the 48th round.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a guy who really wasn't heavily scouted. I mean, some guys had eyes on him, but I mean, he was playing in a Bush League, you know, in South Carolina. Not a lot of people are scouting adult Bush leagues.
Right.
And Chris Kemp, you know, found his way to this kid, and the Rangers popped him in the 48th round. So it's not like, you know, oh, he's going to slide. I mean, they picked him in the 48th round because of Chris Kemp. And he turned out to be a good prospect, and they used him as a secondary piece to land Matt Garza. Now, how much of that is on the player? Well, a lot of it is on the player. But the scout identified what the player had in him and brought mm-hmm. him into the organizational fold. So there's a lot that goes into that as well. The player could always have it in him. Somebody has to be able to believe in that player and give that player the opportunity to blossom. And I think it's the scout's job to identify that, at least at the amateur level. And, you know, that kind of success story will keep you employed for a very long time, and then you'll just be on your way up.
Yeah, and I think that ties in well with, I mean, because obviously CJ Edwards' makeup is a huge reason why he is where he is, and it ties in well with our next question too, which comes from John in Pennsylvania. He says, hey, Morton Star, when did I become Mort? I didn't put a 3 on anybody.
And you also know how to spell. You know the difference between here and here. Which apparently Mort does not.
No, that doesn't surprise
Bless
me.
Bless him.
God love him. The little guy.
By the way, he's a teacher. So.
Yeah. American. Listen, if your kids go to school in Delaware, move. That's,
you might get Mort.
Speaking of Mort, Mort is up in he's up in Syracuse at, like, some amateur showcase, right?
Yeah, he's at the Northeast Showcase.
Dude, that guy is on the road more than fucking anybody, man.
He humps, man.
He totally does.
As long as he's out of the classroom, I feel better about America. Because I just don't trust it, but I love Mort.
I do too. I'm wondering what you guys all makeup teams would be, as in one team each of great players with outstanding makeup and players that had great careers in spite of being complete dickheads and aren't liked by anyone, Albert Bell, or possess a startling lack of self-awareness, like you guys put it, of a guy like A-Rod, or even guys that put on bizarre steroid denial circuits like Braun or Palmeiro's finger wag to Congress. Would you want to field team dickhead if you were running an organization? The talent would be immense, perennial world World Series contender immense, but would it be worth all the off-field rigmarole that having a team like that would cause? How quickly would that team break down internally to the point of where they don't even want to play? I'd imagine that guys like Derek Jeter, Cal Ripken, Mariano Rivera, etc. would populate the all-good guys team, making that list probably a little boring, but I'm still interested to hear what you guys have to offer on both topics. As usual, keep up the great work, John in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. All dickhead team or all nice guy team?
All dickhead team.
What if the dickheads have poor makeup? I mean, let's so, you know, I mean, that's, well, if they have poor makeup, you know, are they going to get the most out of it? Are they?
Yeah. I mean, maybe Albert Bell's a bad example, but I think that there's a misconception about, like,
Palmeiro ratted out his teammate for giving him a B12 shot. That's one of the shittiest teammate things of all time. That'll destroy a clubhouse.
Yeah. I mean, okay, he's an example. But what I was going to say is that there's a lot of people who get, you know, like, oh, Barry Bonds was an asshole. Yeah, you know, Barry Bonds is an asshole. Barry Bonds is going to give you everything he absolutely has on a baseball field. And would I take that player? Fuck yes, I would take that player. I would take that player over Mr. Nice Guy. I don't really care if you're a dickhead or if you're a nice guy. Would I take a team full of nice guys? Well, it depends if they can play baseball. You know, I don't need kindness. You know, is a kind clubhouse a better clubhouse than a clubhouse with that's tense? I don't know. I've never been in a major league clubhouse in that situation, and I can't speak to that. You know, it comes down to me is talent and what you bring to the table and what other people get from you. Mm. You know, if you're an asshole, I don't know if it's going to make other people assholes, but if you're an asshole that comes to the field every day and busts your ass, you know, first to arrive, last to leave, that can rub off on a player. That can make another player work harder, you know, as a result. The same could be true as a guy who shows up and corks his bat and doesn't give a shit, like Albert Bell.
Right.
You know, I mean, and I think that, yeah, that could also have a negative consequence. So I think it depends on what type of dickhead we're talking about here.
Well, it's a dickhead with good makeup or a dickhead with bad makeup is what it amounts to. I mean, are they willing to work to get the most out of their abilities, or are they just going through the motions?
Yeah, I don't want a dickhead with bad makeup. I'll take dickheads with good makeup.
Right. And I
so
think
team dickhead, good makeup.
And, you know, and I think John, you know, John put three guys in here who are obviously like all world players and human beings. I mean, Jeter, Cal, Mariano, you know, they're all respected both on and off the field. But I would caution you in this idea that, you know, who's a good guy, who's a bad guy. There are some guys that are great clubhouse guys that don't do well dealing with us in the media. They just don't do well with it.
Sure.
But behind closed doors, they're fantastic. And there are guys that are leaders that you look at them from the outside and they you know, they may do something, they may be intense, they may snap at you, but they're the guys that are getting everybody rallied around and teaching them how to be professionals. And I think that there's a, you know, that we can kind of get lost in what our public perception is. And even for guys who are in clubhouses a lot, I mean, beat writers, you know, even if they're tight with guys on the team, they don't know what's going on behind closed doors. There's a big difference between that moment and that hour or so when the media is around.
Right, and I think Jim Thome needs to be on this list as well. I mean, he's a guy that doesn't get nearly enough credit for being, you know, one of the all-time good guys.
Oh, dude, he's the best.
What makes him the best?
Jim?
Yeah.
I mean, he's just like he's you know what?
Jimmy?
Jimmers. Here's the thing. Tomey's in a class with guys like, you know, I'll put it like other guys like Mike Sweeney. Sean Casey was the same way. Now, obviously, Tomey was a better player than those two guys. Although Sweeney, for the back injuries, was a pretty damn good player, too. Casey was a good player. But they're guys who treat everybody exactly the same, whether you're a teammate or you're a clubby or you're a media guy or whoever.
Just good people.
He just treats everyone like they're a human being. That's what makes Jim Thome special.
Can't do that. I just don't think people are all the same.
Yeah. No, but that's because you don't like to see the good in people. I understand.
I don't.
Our final email.
There's no time for that shit in the world.
Our final email. This might be a good just kind of instruction email. I thought this was interesting to just kind of this dovetailed off our discussion on starting pitcher rankings from last week or categorizations. It says, Mike and Kevin, I was so sorry to hear of Jason's passing, RIP. in listening to your recent discussion of how many number one starters, number two starters, et cetera, there are on the majors today, it occurred to me that there must be at least a few teams in the majors that don't have a one or even a two. This means that when you say a prospect has a number three ceiling, you are in a sense projecting a ceiling of good enough to be the best pitcher on a major league team, not good enough to be the best pitcher on any major league team, or not good enough to be the best pitcher on most major league teams, but there will be some non-awful teams every year led by a number three. This year's Red Sox are an example of a good team that doesn't have an ace. What numbers would you put on each of their starters? Clay Buchholz, John Lester, John Lackey, Ryan Dempster, Felix Dubron. I guess you could put Jake Peavy in that mix, too. Buchholz had great numbers through 12 starts, but he's been on the shelf for nearly as long as he was healthy. Thanks, and keep up the great work, Michael. I think I loved his description on what, like, one, twos, and threes are. Yeah, a three could be the best starter on a good team that just doesn't have that ace level or that you know, near perennial all-star pitcher.
Yeah, I had a GM tell me once that we don't have a number one or a number two or a number three or a number four. We have five number ones because each day they take the ball, they're the number one starter. And because you don't know how it's going to line up, like we were talking about with the second wild card.
Right.
You know, that guy who, just because he's not our ace, well, we don't want him to think that he's not our ace just because he doesn't line up that way in the rotation. If you're a number fifth starter and you're pitching in game three of the World Series for whatever reason, you're our number one starter that game. And that's how they valued that. And I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at it, you know, because we're all wrapped up in the numbers. Everybody's wrapped up in assigning that distinction to these players. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure it actually matters.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does for a comparison standpoint. But I mean, I understand what the general manager says. I've heard that from plenty of people in baseball too. You know, lots of managers like to say that. I mean, it's a good way to help build confidence in your players, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, just from looking at it from that standpoint, if you're evaluating from the outside where a guy kind of sits, I can certainly see why, you know, it helps to put grades on them in that regard.
Sure.
So, I mean, I understand where that GM or where a manager would come from saying that, but
I've
it doesn't change
I've heard
the fact.
A player dev guy say it too.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. That speaks to mindset. But it doesn't help you in the evaluative process.
No.
You know, I mean, that's what, you know, I think, you know, when he mentions in the email, when Michael mentions, you know, Buchholz, Lester, Lackey, you know, they've got a couple of number, you know, guys like Buchholz and Lester are like number threes with kind of still, they've still got a little bit of projection as number two kind of ceilings. Peavy's, you know, probably a number three, a high three, you know, Lackey's more of a four. Dempster might be, you know, four or five at this point as he struggled a little bit. Dubron's got a ceiling of a four. I mean, those are kind of what you have, but I think that's important. I think from the standpoint of looking at the way, you know, contending teams work out, you don't have to have that ace. That ace is really special. And even those guys that are, you know, that are classified as number twos, like when you put a six grade on a pitcher or a high six and put a high two ceiling on them, mm-hmm. I mean, that's, those guys don't exist very often where they actualize that.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. And the thing with this, these players listed, when you have like Buchholz, Lester, Lackey, you know, throw Peavy in the mix, is that any one of those guys is capable of pitching like an ace. You know, Buchholz, I mean, a lot of his thing is just, you know, staying on the field, staying consistent. Obviously, he's got electric stuff. I think that he could actually project even higher if he can, you know, stay on a field. Lester, in the past, has proven to be a pretty solid number two, three starter type of guy. Mm-hmm. Lackey, in the past, has been a solid number two, three starter type of guy. Hell, even Dempster, in the past, has been a solid number two, number three starter type. You know, obviously, that year to year, the evaluation is going to change based on, you know, their health and, you know, their stuff. But yeah, I mean, this rotate, man, that's a pretty good rotation. Shit,
yeah.
I didn't even realize.
I mean, shit, that's like, it's like four number threes and a four once they get Buchholz healthy. You know, I mean, at the worst,
that ability to step up and show more than just like an average, a back end profile. I mean, these guys have higher profiles; they just don't often perform to that level.
Right. And that's where you start to get into consistency and how that kind of grades out. And that's why that number one, you know, we've talked a lot about that in, you know, this kind of, you know, the unicorn that is a number one starter, is that you getting that consistency, not just start to start, you know, but year to year. You know, and then even when you have down years, you know, like let's use Verlander as an example. Verlander mm-hmm. has not pitched well this year.
No, he hasn't.
But Verlander's a one. I mean, because he's going to end up throwing 230 innings again.
Yeah, he's a one.
The numbers are going to be down. It's a mechanical issue, even with the velocity down a touch. You know, you expect him to come back and The thing is that he is such a talented guy, and his makeup is so strong that even if he starts pitching with diminished stuff, he is going to have a higher aptitude for learning how to pitch with that more effectively, faster.
Well, and like what we talked about off air, even like Shields, who didn't have a good game, you know, you said today, was able to piece it together without his best stuff. I love looking at a pitcher who can do that.
Who's the most unassuming number one? Is it Lee or is it Shields? The one that guy that just doesn't fit the profile of
well,
what you
always
would
been
expect.
Kind of Lee. You know, I mean, Lee was the guy who coming up, people weren't like putting ones on him,
right?
You know, they were like, this is a one guy. I mean, it's just
he got sent back to AAA in 07. He wasn't even on their playoff roster when they went to the LCS.
Yeah, he's just made himself into a one. But I think he's pretty unassuming. I mean, I think Shields, a lot of people don't even consider him a number one, which I think he is.
Oh, I think he is. I mean, I think with the volume of innings you get from him, I think that does it. You know, this is because I was up in Cooperstown this weekend for the longest weekend with no inductees. But we were having this conversation about the Jack Morris Hall of Fame candidacy, and this isn't. I don't think we're breaking new ground, and it's maybe something that we've even brought up before. But I think it was Kevin Kernan from New York Post was telling the story of talking to Sparky Anderson about Morris, and one of Morris's strengths was because you knew he was going to go 7 or 8 innings every time out, or at least 8 innings in that day, that it meant you could empty your bullpen the day before and the day after. And so he ended up affecting 3 games. And that's one of the things that we talk about a lot, at least on our show, when you're talking about frontline starters, is that the impact that they have doesn't show up necessarily in the numbers, but it shows up in, you know, the innings pitched from the bullpen, not just on those days, but the days surrounding it, because it allows you to play the matchups more and keep them fresh. And getting that day off can be huge, especially if you're, you know, if you're in a tough stretch where, you know, you're going 6-4 and your starters are only going 5 innings, man, just getting 7 innings out of that starter, even if he gives up 4 or 5 runs, that can be really important for kind of setting it up, you know, the rest of the way. Trent Rosecrans had a great line a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about, you know, the goal isn't to win every day, it's to win the most games. Not every game, but the most games. And I really liked the way he said that, because that guy can help you even if he loses in that start.
Yeah, and I also liked Morris because when he pitched, it looked like he had an entire can of dip in his mouth. I mean, just a huge chaw. And he was just out there just working it. I mean, just working that chaw. I mean, that he must have strong jaws.
I'll tell you what, man.
He's a strong jaw.
He's turned into a silver fox. Have you seen him lately?
I haven't seen him this year.
Silver fox plus bushy mustache.
Oh, that's a combo.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Looks good. Looks good.
So. Maybe it won't get him in, but it's good.
All right, so we've gone through the emails, and again, you can email us at fringeaverage@baseballperspectives.com if you have some that you want to submit, if we've brought up discussion points that you want to go into. And again, our music this week from the really heavy, but let's just real quick, because we're running short on time today, get into the trade deadline and the complete and total lack of activity there. In the month of July, who was the best player that got moved to a non-contender, do you feel like?
I mean,
was it Olt?
I mean, he's the best prospect, not the best player. I mean, I'd like Garcia more than Olt. You know, I'd probably like Iglesias more than Olt. But as far as like what I do, prospects, yeah, I think it has to be Olt. You know, I'm not a big Grant Green fan.
What about Arrieta?
What about him?
Well, I mean, I just, you know, Arrieta's got obviously the more service time. There's still some upside there. He needed a change of scenery.
I mean, I like everything that they did for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I thought the Cubs and the Orioles, I thought, were the two teams that had the best trade deadline, really, even with Boston adding Peavy.
Yeah, I mean, I like what Boston didn't give up to get what they got.
Yeah.
You know, that Montas is an interesting arm. They gave up, you know, obviously Iglesias is a piece, but you know, when you have a horse like Bogaerts in the upper minors, I mean, it's not that he's superfluous, but I mean, I don't think the Red Sox had to dig very deep. You know, I thought that the Astros, it was kind of meh for me. You know, I think that it's getting that draft pick was the biggest part.
Yeah, I agree.
Because that's going to free up some space for them, because obviously they're probably going to have to. Their 1-1 is going to be pretty expensive.
Yeah.
And that's going to give them some extra funds there, and that's a big deal. Hater's kind of a, you know, whatever. I'm not a big hose guy.
But the people who like Hader really like Hader. I mean, that's the thing, is they really like him, and then there's some that are like, you know, he's a loogie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if he gets to that level.
Right.
I mean, if he even gets up there. I thought, you know, I'm not a big Kyle Smith guy either, but for what they traded him, I mean, they traded him for a guy that was not in the future plans of the organization. I mean,
right.
I wouldn't be surprised if they had just dumped him. Right. So you get a guy like Kyle Smith for that, even though Kyle Smith doesn't have the biggest ceiling. I mean, you know, they were able to add some players. Again, not any kind of impact guys. I mean, I don't see of these guys who were traded. I mean, you know, getting a guy like Danry Vasquez, maybe, you know, that they were able to trade for the reliever. I think that, you know, he's a young kid, but he's got some bat to ball ability. There's some raw there that he's going to tap into as he continues to physically mature. I mean, it's a weird profile. It's more of a corner, like a left profile. So he's going to have to hit the baseball. But, I mean, you know, out of all these guys, I mean, aside from like Olt or something, I think Vasquez has the highest potential. You know, I'm not a big hose guy. Edwards is all right. I mean, there's something there. I mean, there's a major league future there. Grant Green's obviously got a major league future. Olt's got a major league future. But, you know, we didn't see that impact guy go. You know, we didn't see a Polanco get traded for Rios. We didn't see a Glasnow get traded. We didn't see a Cecchini get traded. You know, a lot of the guys that were mentioned to get traded, we didn't really see. And so you're left with, you know, a prospect list that it's not all that sexy. I mean, there could be some impact guys down the line, maybe. I mean, you never know. When a guy like Frank Montes, I mean, he can throw 100 miles an hour. So you teach him some command. He maybe figures out a breaking ball that he can stick with. Maybe that's a late-inning reliever that can pitch at impact just because of the velocity. But on the surface, you know, it's really not that exciting.
Yeah. I think he's interesting just because of the organization he's going to, too, because if they do something well, it's work with pitchers. So I liked the idea of Montes going to the White Sox from that standpoint. And I think from the big league level, I mean, I think Baltimore was you know, in a market where, you know.
I love what they did.
They upgraded 40% of their rotation and added a key bullpen arm. And kept the bullpen arm from a division rival, without giving up anything.
What did they give up?
They valued stuff properly. I mean, I guess I was there last night, and it hurt to give away Hader for them because they didn't want to give away a left-handed pitcher. Hader's a local kid, and they were really upset to give him away from a standpoint of, you know, there's a lot of, you know, good stories with it, and, you know, they really think he's, you know, he's got a chance to be a guy who can pitch, you know, in a rotation at some point.
Winning's a good story too.
Yeah. And, I mean, he's 19 years old though.
I know. I
mean, he's 19 years old, and they got a controllable starting pitcher for 2.5 years. You know, a guy who's a number four, maybe a low three, you know, at least the way he's pitched this year has been that way. Mm-hmm. And you know what? The biggest thing that they gave up, I really felt like, was the comp pick. Yeah. I mean, I think that was, you know, that's the one thing you can go, well, that may have been a little rich in that. But again, you got a starting pitcher for 2.5 years at the big league level. They're the only guys that rebuilt their team really at the trade deadline. They have 40% of their starting rotation they fixed.
I know. I mean, outside of Mike Olt, I'd probably put that comp pick as the second best prospect that got traded this summer.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a valuable piece in this draft and given where the Astros are picking.
Yeah.
And they're going 1-1 and they're going to need that extra money. I think that's a big deal.
Oh, man.
Rodon. Yeah.
Rodon. They're going to get him.
They're going to get him. Fuck them. They're going to get him.
You know what? The White Sox may catch him.
Yeah, but it's great to lose, isn't it? Hey, let's reward the losers. I hate that.
You want to do the draft lottery, like, or the ping pong balls like the NBA?
No, that sucks too. I don't have a good solution, or I'd write about it. I just like the bitch.
I mean, I think that's, you know, this is something that's come up a lot. I'm glad you brought it up actually, because this has come up a lot in conversation with people, whether it be writers or people around baseball, in just the standpoint of that there is no, you know, that idea of competing to win, you know, 80 games or win 83 games is gone, that it's almost more beneficial to lose 100 than it is to lose, you know, 85, because you know, development be damned, or, you know, if there's any value to learning how to win at the big league level, that be damned, because you're going to end up getting more money in the draft. I mean, Boris has been huge against that. I mean, Boris is basically screaming from the mountaintops about how awful this is for baseball.
Well, I think it's terrible, because I think that, you know, and just speaking of the Astros, but this could be any team that finishes with the worst record in baseball, is that let me go ahead and give you every advantage now because you were terrible. Mm-hmm. Let me give you more money. Let me allow you to pick early. You know, I mean, the money, the funds, that's what really bothers me. I mean, the worst team in baseball gets the most money to spend on amateur acquisition. That bothers the fuck out of me.
Right.
Why should that be the case?
And it would bother you a lot less, I bet, if everybody had the chance to spend the same amount, because then there's decisions to be made.
I don't mind that.
The old system.
If you want a level playing field, make it level.
Right. I mean, listen, if you really want a level playing field, get rid of the draft. I mean, that's if you really want to be a free market economy, get rid of the draft. And it'll take care of itself. The spending will take care of itself, but that'll never happen.
Yeah, I mean it's a messy situation, but I mean there's a lot of messy situations in baseball right now.
Well, yeah, and I want to get to that too, because here was the other thing: the biggest overpay in terms of acquiring talent was Detroit sending Garcia to the Red Sox for Iglesias. I mean that's a steep price to pay for a defense only shortstop, don't you think? Trading Garcia, a guy who's got a chance to be a 20-80 corner bat.
I think that it depends on the scouting of Iglesias' bat.
Okay. Do you think Iglesias can hit enough to be a major league regular?
Yeah, I do.
Do you think – and how much is enough?
260.
You think he can – you think he's a five hitter? Okay.
I think he's a down-the-lineup eight shortstop.
Okay.
And would I want that on my team if I have – you know, it would depend on the makeup of my pitchers. It would depend on what I have in the lineup to – but see, they have enough in the lineup that they don't need to get production like that from the shortstop.
Sure,
position.
And they have two really good ground ball pitchers in Fister and Porcello that are going to benefit.
Yeah,
from
so
that.
If I can make them better, and I can sneak him at the back of the lineup without impacting the offense, fuck yeah, I'm going to take an eight glove.
Okay.
Hell
all
yeah,
right.
Plus I love watching him.
Yeah, and that's fine. But I mean, the whole reason that they had to make that deal was because Peralta's going to get suspended.
Sure.
I mean, that's the whole thing, is they basically got backed into a corner because they don't have another shortstop that was available. So they had to give up something that was a premium chip that's power, you know, power at the corners, and there's no power in the game, especially in the minor leagues. You know, even if the ceiling is as a 20 homer guy, how many 20 homer guys are there left that are coming up? I mean, it's not a ton.
Well,
and
yeah,
they had
I mean,
to give that up to get
a 280-290 20 home run guy and play good defense. I mean, he's a lot faster than his body would suggest.
He's played
I mean,
he's a lot like a, of center field.
Yeah, I mean, he's a good – he's a five-tool guy.
Mm-hmm.
He really is. He's a five-tool player. I like him a lot. I mean, would I take him over Iglesias? Yeah, I mean, maybe. I don't know. I'd go back and forth on that. I love defense.
Mm-hmm.
I love up-the-middle defense like that. I'd love watching him play. I don't think the bat is special, but, I mean, he's got hand-eye coordination. He's got some feel for contact. He's not an empty stick. I think he could be a down-the-lineup type of hitter with the eight glove. I think that's a pretty decent guy to have.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a lot just because of the situation they were in, and that's
well, right. I mean, how long is he going to get? What's his pop? 50 or 100?
That's probably going to be 50. I mean, he sounds like he's going to be a guy that plays.
So he's not going to get a lifetime ban, whatever that means. Well, actually, let me. What does that mean? Can you do that?
I don't know. I mean, this by the time the podcast comes out, the suspensions may have been handed down. I mean, it's supposed to come at some point, probably on Friday, but the Major League Baseball is trying to threaten Alex Rodriguez with a lifetime ban under the kind of basically the best interest of baseball clause, which is in the CBA in essence to try and prevent guys from gambling on the game. I mean, that's the way it was created, but they're trying to use it in a different way because Alex Rodriguez tried to impede their investigation into Biogenesis. You know, he was trying before Major League Baseball went out and paid Tony Bosch, he was trying to buy the documents away from Biogenesis so that he could destroy them. At least is what Major League Baseball's claim is. Now, A-Rod says that he still has never done anything wrong, but this is what the claim is, and that's
the
why they're going down this
route. Wrong. That was all right.
I don't know, man. That's pretty great, you know. So that's why they're trying to go down this road. But man, it's all negotiation. I mean, you threaten that shit, and A-Rod's attorneys go on radio in New York, and they say, "Well, we're not going to accept any suspension." What do you hear last night from ESPN? Two sides are talking. They're negotiating a deal. I mean,
What do you think? What do you think the deal's going to be? What's your gut say?
I mean, I bet you it's probably it's going to be more than Braun. I'd say, let's say it ends up getting. I want to say it'll probably end up being like 150 games. He comes back towards the end of next year because
why,
if he gets suspended,
are they
allowed
to negotiate this in the first place?
Because it's not covered under the drug testing part of the joint drug agreement.
Okay.
It's a non-analytical positive.
Okay.
So they have evidence that he did it. But they didn't have a failed drug test, so it doesn't fall. So it would have been better if he'd pissed in a cup and been popped. He'd already have served his 50-game suspension. He'd be done.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's basically, you know, that's – I mean,
I just don't like hearing lifetime ban. I don't like people throwing around lifetime ban.
So I got to talk to Pete Rose last weekend. Which is actually awesome. If you ever get a chance to talk baseball with Pete Rose, he actually watches more baseball, I think, than anybody else.
That's a guy who sits with a wide stance.
Yes,
holy
indeed.
Shit.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of reason to keep him wide. He sits like John Gruden sits.
Yeah.
You know how Gruden sits with that moose knuckle hanging down? Just like Rose, it's very masculine. It's proto-masculinity.
Rose was talking about the lifetime ban and how he knows he's friends with Alex Rodriguez, and so he doesn't want to see it happen to him. But he said, you know, lifetime is a long, long time. He's like, that. I would hate for anyone to have that. You know, and he's totally anti-PEDs, and he doesn't see the similarities between it and amphetamines and all of that. He says, life is a long, long time, and I would hate to see somebody have that taken from them. And this is a guy, I mean, obviously he knows. And, you know, his whole advice for, like, Ryan Braun was like, well, I would have advised him like a year and a half ago, just tell the truth. He's like, look at what the line got me. He's like, I'm still out of the game. And I just learned last week that, you know, Rose had an option to take a 7-year ban or a 10-year ban or a lifetime ban with one where he could apply for reinstatement after 1 year. You know, I mean that, and that's, he's still serving that. He had a chance to apply for reinstatement after 1 year and he's still serving that lifetime ban.
What do you think about that? I mean, you think that should be lifted? You think he's a Hall of Famer? You think that he should be a part of baseball?
Well, I think the Hall of Fame thing is separate. I mean, because the Hall of Fame banned, if you are on baseball's banned list, you are not allowed to be voted on for the Hall of Fame. The Hall put that rule in when Rose was banned. So really they could lift that and he could go into the Hall of Fame. And
you think he's a Hall of
Famer? Fuck yeah, he's a Hall of Famer. I mean, as a player, don't you think he's a Hall of Famer as a player?
Absolutely. I love him. Yeah,
Jesus Christ, the guy's the all-time hits leader. I mean, he is want and rig. I mean, he's all of it. He's and he is one of the smartest baseball people, I think, on the planet. I don't think anybody loves the game or analyzes the game or understands the game better than Pete Rose. I actually think he would have been a fabulous manager if he could have kept managing because he knows that everybody's different. And, you know, he wasn't the most talented guy. You know, a lot of times guys at the Hall of Famers, and we've touched on this, they don't, you know, they expect guys to do things that they did because they could do it. Rose wasn't that guy. He knew who to kick in the ass and who needed a pat on the back. You know, and who needed him to get out of his way. He learned that from Sparky Anderson, and I think he would have been a fantastic manager. And I would love to see him be able to be involved in the game again. I'd love to see them lift the ban because, one, I think he can give a lot of life lessons to kids about what not to do, you know, how to man up, how to not follow his mistakes. But, two, man, there's a lot of things you can learn on a baseball field from Pete Rose because he's Pete fucking Rose, and he's a really good teacher of the game.
Well, I think that's one of the problems with baseball, though, is not being able to recognize what he could add to the game right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's 71 or 72 years old. I mean, man, hurry up and get him back in the game, please. I mean,
do you think it happens?
Maybe with the next commissioner.
You just don't think it's going to happen with Selig?
He, you know, he lied to Selig about the gambling stuff, and then he came clean when he did the tell-all. And I wish he would just kind of let it go, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think maybe with the next commissioner it happens. But that's still 2 years away, if you believe that Selig's actually retiring this time.
I'd like to see it, though, man. There's nothing better than watching old highlights of Rose. I mean, just tons of want. I mean, just dripping wet with want. And just a terrible haircut, massive head.
Yeah. Oh, he's still got the massive noggin. Wearing a camouflage Reds hat while he was signing autographs in Cooperstown, but
just letting it ride high on there.
Yeah. I get some pictures I can send you. It's pretty great.
Oh man!
All right, wow. So you're going to Cincinnati?
I'm going to Cincinnati tomorrow. I have the event tomorrow night, like Friday night. I'm going to be drinking at Motor Pub, which is a great bar in Cincinnati, and hopefully getting to catch up with some friends that I have in the area. Then Saturday is the event, and then on to San Diego for a Perfect Game All-American tournament. Looking
nice.
Forward to it. All-American game. So
nice. Sounds like it's going to be fun. Well,
oh, man, it's going to be great.
Safe travels to you.
Thank you, Michael. What do you have?
I don't. My dad's actually coming to town this weekend. He never comes out to visit, so my dad's going to come and hang out with us for the weekend, which is going to be a lot of fun. So,
excellent.
Yeah, so we're going to go do D.C. things, go hit some museums, go eat some crabs, and just kind of hang out, which it'll be a nice chill weekend. It's nice to be home for a little while. So,
yeah, I bet.
So, yeah, well, you'll learn what that's like in a couple weeks.
Right. I'm looking forward to it.
Hey, at least you're going to see games. I mean,
yeah.
That's what you want to be doing anyway. So
yeah, I like seeing games. I like being. I like meeting people who like to go to games. I like meeting fans in different cities. That's really been cool.
Yeah. Well, enjoy.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll be back next week, we hope, while Jason's in San Diego. I'm going to bet dimes to donuts that we will be doing a show next week. We'll just have to figure out when. So music from the Really Heavy takes you out of here. It's their first single, Forever Untitled, from their new EP, Chatterbox. Goodbye, Jason.
Goodbye, Mark.
Dick.
Yeah.
Bite it off, bite it off, bite it off.